You're listening to the Radio Cafe, coming to you from the Santa Fe, New Mexican. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. First of all, I want to wish everybody a very happy new year. And as we look forward to this new year, it seems like this is a time when a lot of people are trying to make sense of the political situation in the U.S. So I thought this would be a good time to call on our friend Kirk Ellis to give us some historical context. Now, I've been listening to the Alexander Hamilton musical, the soundtrack to the musical, which, if you haven't heard it, is amazing on many levels, and I read the biography that inspired the musical and some other books about that period, and it seems like a really good moment to look more closely at the founding of our country, what people were arguing about then, and what were the problems they were trying to solve by creating a new government. Which is why we're talking to Kirk Ellis. He is a writer and producer. He wrote the John Adams series for HBO. He's an expert on the founding period of our country. He's won 2 Emmy Awards, a Writers Guild of America Award, a Peabody Award, and the Humanitas Prize. I talked to him in his office here in Santa Fe. Welcome, Kirk Ellis.
Happy to be here, Mary Shirley. Thank you.
So we are talking today about this polarized political time that we're living in. And there's a lot of talk in the media about how there's never been such a polarized time. But, you know, when we look back at our founding period, which was well over 200 years ago, it was pretty darn polarized then. Once the Revolutionary War was over, we were united under that, then immediately split off into all kinds of different factions. And part of what happened in the first decades of our republic was we said, okay, we need a constitution. What should that constitution be? That was controversial. What were some of the problems that our founders were worried about that they thought the constitution would help solve, or maybe that they thought it wouldn't solve?
It seems very strange to us today to make the statement that when the Constitution was pronounced, not everybody thought it was a good idea. There's a famous story about Thomas Jefferson and John Adams, both of whom were overseas as ambassadors for the United States when the Constitutional Convention was meeting and when they promulgated the results. And Adams considered it to be a very, very good document to base a government on. Jefferson was of a totally different opinion about that. He thought it gave too much power to the president, and that there were too many violations of individual rights. And it became a kind of battleground to determine which states were going to actually ratify the Constitution. And it was a very close-run thing, and among the states on the fence was New York. And Alexander Hamilton, one of the sons of New York, and one of the principal architects of the Constitution, decided that it would be necessary to wage what we would now call a PR campaign on behalf of the document. And that resulted in this incredible set of newspaper articles that we know as the Federalist Papers. And Hamilton was not the only author of that. He had worked with James Madison and John Jay. But in fact, as everybody knows from the musical Hamilton, that great lyric, "Why do you write? You're writing like you're running out of time." He did the majority of the work on the Federalist Papers. There are, in fact, 85 articles, and of those, Hamilton wrote 51 of them, Madison wrote 29, and John Jay wrote only 5. But they set the standard for how people were going to interpret the government that we still have today, that endures for all of its problems. The biggest issue was this issue of democracy. Now, the founders were all students of the classics. They knew Greek and Roman writers, and they knew Greek and Roman government. And from that study, they all concluded pure democracy would be a disaster because it would give rise to demagoguery and manipulation.
What did they mean by pure democracy in the first place?
Well, they were looking at, say, the experiment of Pericles in the 5th century BC, where anyone could serve. It was literally a lottery, and every man, and it was, as it was in our founding period, a very male duty that one had to serve. you could be the lowliest person or you could be the most aristocratic, but you would, your number would come up at some point. But everything was decided by acclamation. There was no representation of a constituency. And it's always misleading for Americans and pundits to talk about the American democratic experiment. We're not a democracy. That's not what the founders set up. They set up a representative republic because they believed that that system, which was based in large degree on the system of the British government and the Magna Carta, that it would work to counter abuses and that any residual effect would further be countered by the rapid expansion of the United States. That as the country got bigger, the tendency for people to band together as a cause against a whole bunch of other people would lessen. Now, we know today that that hasn't necessarily manifested itself, but for a good long run in our history, it was something that they had anticipated and corrected.
One of the things that's really interesting to me about Alexander Hamilton was he recognized exactly what you're talking about, that the British government already had some really good principles, and yet we were throwing to fight off the tyranny of the British government. We fought a whole war of independence for it. And the fact that Hamilton was trying to take what was good from it made a lot of people think that he was a monarchist or in favor of the old system.
It wasn't just Hamilton. It was people in the Federalist Party, John Adams being principal among them, who were constantly accused of being monarchists. There was, I suppose, an understandable reaction by people saying, well, wait, we just fought this war, and now we want to adopt their form of government. And there was a separate regional factionalism in the sense that you had a northern society represented by New England and by people like Alexander Hamilton who saw the future of America in manufacturing and commercial enterprise. And you had people on the southern side of that equation who believed America was going to prosper as an agrarian society. That was famously Thomas Jefferson's belief. How seriously he held it, I don't know, because everything he did as president contradicted so much of his early political philosophy. But I like to say that Americans tend to think we are Jeffersonian in our legacy, but we actually live in the government that was conceptualized and organized by people like John Adams and Alexander Hamilton.
So let's talk about what each of them was worried about and how they tried to solve it. I mean, one of the things that they were worried about was the fact that there were really different factions that believed different things politically, believed different things about how the country should be governed. Expand on that for us, and how did each side think we should address that problem?
So let's first get a definition of faction, as it was understood in the late 18th century American parlance. James Madison, who was the author of Federalist Number 10, which is one of the longest essays in the collection, and the one that most explicitly lays out what factionalism is and how the Constitution will work to counter its effects. He says, by a faction, I understand a number of citizens, whether amounting to a majority or a minority of the whole, who are united and actuated by some common impulse of passion or interest, adverse to the rights of other citizens or to the permanent and aggregate interests of the community. And this is how the founders defined factionalism. They saw liberty as freedom to achieve one's best success. Liberty was very much thought of as an economic liberty. You were not bound by class. If you were a self-starter and you achieved things, you could do well. But they hitched liberty to responsibility. Hence that nature of faction is a band of people who get together and work against the common interest. That's what everybody was afraid of.
Now, what kind of common interest, like what would be some examples of that from that period?
Well, again, there was not general agreement about it. And it's misleading for people to think that the founders wrote the Constitution not really understanding how quickly parties would manifest themselves. Faction was at the very forefront of their minds. What they did not foresee is rapid division by sectionalism, by economic disparities. There was a wonderful article, for instance, in the New York Times a few weeks ago that said the one thing the founders did not anticipate is how different the economic strata would become over the course of 200 years. They never saw a society that had that much inequity between the lowliest of the poor and the richest of the wealthy. And that is the situation we found ourselves in recently. And I suppose there are a lot of people who would blame Alexander Hamilton for that, for making sure that we were a society that was initially crafted on a commercial enterprise.
Nevertheless, they did see that factions of one kind or another were inevitable because there was inequality. Some people were big landowners, some people were small landowners, some people didn't own land at all.
Right.
And some people were working in manufacturing, some people were farmers. They understood that, and that those people would gather around their political interests.
Right.
Which is fine. I mean, that's what government is all about, isn't it? And so the question of factions wasn't that people would have different political interests and fight it out, but that one group would impinge on the interests of the others in a really harmful way.
Right.
And what were some of those ways that they were seeing or foreseeing?
Well, if you take it from a strictly regional standpoint, the South was worried about the fact that that Northern manufacturing would make their agricultural way of life obsolete. And I'm not talking about the slavery aspect. The founders kicked that one down the road at least a generation or more. But it was this idea that America, to survive, could not rely on a passive industry like agriculture. It needed to actually create goods that it could then export. That was the big difference.
So did the Southerners at that time think that Northern manufacturing would undermine their own rights?
That is correct, yes.
And their own rights to what?
To earn a living. The issue with liberty was your living interferes with my living. Therefore, there is conflict.
And that's such an interesting proposition, because in anything that we are looking at, whether it be in the late 18th century or in the early 21st century, there will be people who say, I have the right to do anything I want.
Correct.
And others will say, you are undermining my way of living.
Well, you have the right to your opinion. You have the right to your way of life, but you do not have the right to infringe on the rights and responsibilities of others. That's how our system is put together.
But I think the big question is, what constitutes infringement?
Well, I guess that is the big question.
Yeah. We will probably circle around to that. But meanwhile, I think what was so interesting about this fight over the Constitution was that, I mean, let's say you take it as a given that there's going to be factions, there's going to be political differences because you've got differences of experience and you've got inequality. What do? The Federalists said, let's have a big, strong, centralized republic. The Anti-Federalists said, let's have smaller states and a weak republic. And both of them made arguments that that would address this problem.
So that's not quite 100% the difference between Federalists and Anti-Federalists. I think that you're right about Federalism. The idea was that you needed a strong central authority with certain delegated rights and responsibilities, which are enumerated in the Constitution. And then as now, there's still room for interpretation. The Anti-Federalists believed that it was what we would call states' rights, that the states were the owners of those rights, and that they would dictate to their citizens for their own benefit what these rules would be. And the federal government would not have the kind of responsibility that the Constitution created and that we have today. But this is, again, whether you're talking about the Sagebrush Rebellion or various social issues, it comes down to that same argument. I think that the blessing and the curse of our system of government is that it was designed to be forever a work in progress. There is no definitive answer to the debate between Thomas Jefferson and John Adams on, is America best served by a strong executive or a strong legislature? We constantly pivot between those two principles, and we haven't resolved what works best. If you're thinking about eras like trust busting, when you had a strong executive like Teddy Roosevelt who ran roughshod over Congress, yes, maybe that was the right approach. The same thing without Franklin Delano Roosevelt's authoritarian bent, the New Deal never would have happened. But on the other hand, you had somebody like Lyndon Baines Johnson in the lead up to civil rights and the Great Society who knew how to work with Congress because he had come from the legislative branch and knew that particular closed society intimately. So we're never going to have an answer to which system works best. And that's, I think, by design in the Constitution.
Part of what a number of our founders, including Alexander Hamilton, were very clear about was that you do need people, particularly the executive and people in elected office, and including the Electoral College, the way it was set up then, to be people of integrity, to be people of wisdom and intelligence.
I think the word there is educated. If you go to the Jefferson Memorial in Washington, D.C., you will see inscribed around it this whole idea that democracy and representative republics are based on an educated populace. When they were talking about education, they meant people who were steeped in classical virtues, duty, honor, responsibility, integrity, all of those things. What does education consist of in a 21st century reality? How are people informed about the government? When the Federalist Papers came out in New York, they were read by everybody who was able to vote. And they were devoured, and they were people who understood the language and understood the concepts. We have debased the debate because of social media, because of the blogosphere, and because we silo information so we only hear what we want to hear. Now, that's not to say that the press was any better then. It was strictly a partisan affair. When you get to the election of 1800, where there was this belief on both sides, the Federalist and the Anti-Federalist side, that if either side won, America as we know it would cease to exist.
America as we know it being like less than 25 years
That's,
old.
Well, not, in terms of the government, it was the, let's see, you had Washington elected twice, Adams elected once, who was only 12 years old. So, yeah, but that's how intense those debates were then. I go crazy when people say, well, politics now is dirty and the issues are everybody is so doctrinaire. Like they weren't then. Right. Of course they were.
Yeah, I mean, yellow journalism and gerrymandering. I mean, gerrymandering
comes from the Elbridge Gerry, who right. was one of the architects of independence.
Right. And all kinds of lies and dirty tricks. And where was that reading? I think it might have been in the Hamilton, one of the Hamilton biographies, the vociferous complaints about the incompetence of Congress.
Yes.
It was from the beginning.
From the beginning. Well, that from the beginning of the Revolution, actually.
Yeah.
When they were refusing to arm and clothe Washington's troops. And those arguments don't change. As a matter of fact, Madison refers to them directly at the very beginning of Federalist 10. He says, complaints are everywhere heard from our most considerate and virtuous citizens, equally the friends of public and private faith and of public and personal liberty, that our governments are too unstable, that the public good is disregarded in the conflicts of rival parties, and that measures are too often decided not according to the rules of justice and the rights of the minor party, but by the superior force of an interested and overbearing majority. Does that sound familiar?
Exactly. And so this question of, I mean, you've got two sets of questions. One is, what is an educated populace? And then, what is a good leader? Mm-hmm. A leader with integrity and education and somebody who is not going to be corrupted by self-interest.
Right.
And it seems to me that Hamilton really thought that if this republic were to flourish, we would have to have leaders who have more integrity than the populace. Whereas Jefferson, at least by rhetoric, kind of put his vote with the populace.
Yeah, that came from their understanding of Greek, especially Greek democracy, and its spectacular failure in the 5th century BC, which was that it was not a meritocracy. Anybody could become ruler, what they called archon of Athens. And it didn't matter if you were educated or if you were aristocratic or poor, it didn't matter. But the problem was is that if anybody could lead, then what was the point of leadership? And they knew that they had to have a system by which leaders could be selected to represent the public. Now, they also foresaw, I mean, nobody at the Constitutional Convention believed that America would be limited to those colonies. In fact, there had already been westward expansion into Ohio Territory, into western Pennsylvania. There was a lot of migration west, and it was everyone's ambition, Jefferson's most spectacularly, that the American Republic, I almost said American Empire, but I was thinking about Jefferson, he never would have thought of it that way, would extend from ocean to ocean. So built into the arguments for the Constitution was this idea that don't worry about demagogues, don't worry about mob mentality, because as our republic spreads out, it will diffuse those arguments. The larger the republic, the more diverse the voices that we will hear, and therefore it's entirely likely that a demagogue will not arise, because his power and influence will be diffused over the nation as a whole.
What do you think of that argument?
Well, it hasn't worked. I mean, I think that what we're seeing now is this rise in, I'll call it, nativist sentiment that we haven't seen really since the decades leading up to the Civil War, with parties like the Know Nothing Party, where it was about this is who we are. It's about us. It's not about them. There was that attempt to divide America even at its founding.
Who was us and them? What did that mean at the time?
Well, I think us and them migrated depending on who was saying it. At the point, I mean, the Civil War is the ultimate us and them argument in America. And you would have thought that after that, there would be more unity. But now, certainly since the turn of the 20th century and the rise of industrialization and the polarization of our economy, us and them is now the haves and the have-nots. I think it's been that for a long time, and it's only getting worse.
Going back to this whole question, I mean, it's a political philosophy question. It's also really a kind of a practical question of how do you ensure that your leaders have integrity, and how do you ensure that the population has enough intelligence and education to elect the right people? I mean, this was a concern of many people, including Alexander Hamilton. It comes up in Federalist Number 10, the essay you were referring to
right,
a few moments ago.
Yeah, men of factious tempers, of local prejudices, or of sinister designs may by intrigue, by corruption, or by other means first obtain the suffrages and then betray the interests of the people. And I have to say once again, that could be taken from yesterday's headline.
Right.
Okay. Now, that's an initial sentence in a long paragraph that goes on to say they can do that on a local level, but the system is set up to where on a national level it's almost impossible for that to happen.
That was the idea anyway.
That was the idea. Exactly.
One of the things that I'm noticing as I continue to have conversations about and read about our founding is that the people on whose continent we are living and were living at the time and that we colonized are virtually written out of the story. I mean, they're just the whole question of colonialism. It was taken as a good, colonialism was a good, and the people who were living before are virtually disregarded. Was that, I mean,
Like I don't think
Jefferson, Madison, Hamilton, they just pretended that Native people didn't exist?
Well, I don't think it was in their consciousness. It really wasn't. You know, now, for some, slavery was. John Adams was the only founding father who didn't own slaves.
Hamilton.
Hamilton was a different generation. Hamilton was younger. So he comes to the fore later. But of that group, Washington, Jefferson, Adams, Madison, Monroe, that group. But there were people like Hamilton who come onto the scene later who have some familiarity with slavery in their own home countries. Because remember, Hamilton's not American by birth. He's from the West Indies. And so they think about slavery in terms of liberty. But does anybody give any conscious thought to Native American society? No, they never did. It was not something they thought about.
I'm kind of obsessed with Hamilton, partly because of the Hamilton musical.
Sure.
And his life and his thought were so interesting to me because he was so afraid that the Republic could fall apart at any time. He didn't know if it would last another 5 years or 10 years.
None of them did.
None of them
that
did.
That wasn't just, he wasn't alone in that. None of them were sure.
And a lot of what he foresaw kind of came to pass in the Civil War. I mean, the faction did, in fact, break off, and another war was fought.
But Hamilton, like the rest of them, did nothing to inhibit that. Everybody knew it was going to be a problem, and everybody chose to ignore it because the issue first was independence, and then it was establishing the country. And so there was a tacit agreement to overlook that sectional difference, that one half of the country existed on the backs of an enslaved population.
What could they have done differently?
I wouldn't want to put myself in their shoes and speculate.
Yeah.
I mean, when the issue came up in the writing of the Declaration of Independence, and Adams and Franklin look at the document, Franklin is the first to say, you know, the issue here before us, Mr. Jefferson, is independence, not emancipation. So there, you know, even Jefferson was thinking about this as an issue that could cause a great deal of strife, but it was decided that, because remember, independence was not, it was a negotiated independence. It was backroom dealing, seeing how many votes you had in each of the delegations to actually get independence across the finish line. So, and then when the Constitution is written and initial amendments are made, it's the idea that the slave trade will be abolished by a certain period, within a decade of the writing of the Constitution. But slavery itself will continue to exist, and the sale of slaves within the existing confines of the United States would be allowed. That was the compromise they made. We'll end the slave trade, and then I think many Northerners thought, well, we'll end the slave trade, and then therefore it will just atrophy, and we won't have to worry about it. Well, of course, that's not what happened.
When you look at today's politics, and
do we have to?
You know, I mean, it's shocking to many people, and I find myself wondering how we got here, and I think it's important to kind of trace how we got here. But when you look at, for example, the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, you look at Hamilton and Jefferson, just to take two characters, you could take others as well, and try to say, well, who's the liberal and who's the conservative? It doesn't quite work. I mean, Hamilton, he was an immigrant. He was a northerner. He was in favor of a strong financial system, a strong military. He put in place the whole idea of military academies and didn't want these like little ragtag state militias that we read about briefly in the Second Amendment. He wanted a true army and navy and so on. Infrastructure, administrations, bureaucratic systems. He was an intellectual. He was a devout Christian, very deeply anti-slavery. He was a realist, a pragmatist, all those things. Then you look at Jefferson on the other side. He was a southerner. He was rural. He was more of an idealist than a pragmatist. He wanted to be a nation of yeoman farmers, and yet he was a lifelong slave owner.
Right,
so that's
right.
Not exactly a yeoman farmer. He was quite ambivalent about racial equality. He wanted those little state militias, and he wanted to have a confederation of strong states, weak national government. He was, if not an atheist himself, at least sympathetic to atheism. And so if you try to map that onto what passes today's right. liberals and conservatives, it doesn't even work.
No, we can't label the founding generation the way we label ourselves today. We can't. As liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, those party labels have changed repeatedly over time. The Republican Party today isn't what it was in Lincoln's time, and in Lincoln's time, it wasn't what it was in Jefferson's time when it was called the Democratic Republican Party.
Right.
Okay. And the Federalists were known as Whigs. So W-H-I-G-S, I should say. So no, none of that transfers.
I mean, today's Republican Party isn't even what it was 50 years ago.
That's correct.
When William F. Buckley was the elitist. Now
right.
the elitism has been sort of pushed onto the other party.
That's correct. So there are the founders steadfastly elude classification because they were men of the Enlightenment, and they agreed on more than they disagreed. And it's their disagreements that got enshrined in the Constitution as the system of checks and balances, which is unique to our government, doesn't exist, say, in the British Parliament.
What did they agree on?
Well, I think the idea that America had to stand up on its own two legs and become a country that could be reckoned with was the thing that was on everybody's mind. It was the mechanism by which America would do that caused the most disagreement early on. And that was an economic rather than a philosophical belief. And I think this idea of America as a country that what we would now call American exceptionalism, I think the founders probably believed in that to a certain degree, in this idea that America had been created in a way that no other republic had been created before. Remember that election that put John Adams into power after two terms of Washington was the first time power had been transferred from one party to another without violence anywhere in the Western Hemisphere. And for all of the vitriol that went into it in the American press, it was looked upon in Europe as a kind of miracle that had happened. America survived that. Nobody expected us to. And that's the beauty of the American experiment, is that it does that. I mean, Condoleezza Rice, who, as you know, was Secretary of State under George W. Bush, recently published a terrific book based on her experiences as a diplomat, and it's about democracy, and it's called Democracy, and it's how the American system of government was set up and how people have tried to emulate it over the course of time. And she says something really interesting in it. She says the American government was designed to require constant engagement, not just by officials, but by citizens at multiple levels, local, state, and national. Americans were thus given peaceful means to contest political questions. That battleground was and has always been to lay claims before an American Constitution that has by any standard enjoyed a remarkable run. The founders presciently built in mechanisms for revision, litigation, and evolution. In a sense, the struggle to make American democracy a bit better and inclusive, little by little, is the story at the core of its stability and success. Two points to be taken from that. When you look at the Constitution and the amendments to the Constitution, the vast majority of them are about expanding suffrage. First to black men, then to women, then to youth. And the idea of America is that it is an inclusive society. So when you have political discussion now that's about making it harder to be an American, you're going against what is in our founding document. The other point is this idea of engagement. Okay, all of the vitriol in the election of 1800 and around the time of the debate over the Constitution came from a group of people who believed that government was the solution. Now, we have a populace that hates government and that sends people to office who hate government and want to drain the swamp, whatever term you use there. The idea is that government doesn't work, we're going to blow it up. That would have been an inconceivable philosophy in the founding generation. The whole idea was that government exists to exercise the will of the people. And you can't have effective leadership an effective government if the voters themselves are selecting people who believe that government doesn't work and that government should be reduced to a bare minimum. No, that's not the way to do it.
Well, and it's certainly not what our founders intended. The idea that there can be liberty without government or only with the most minimal government in a large and complex society is sort of like saying you can have a large and complex organism like a mammal without regulating temperature and without regulating pH and without regulating all the systems that make the body function properly.
So this is me speaking as Kirk Ellis. I'm not speaking on behalf of my research into the founding generation or trying to paraphrase anybody. Liberty without government is sheer unadulterated anarchy. Think about just the semantics of the word government. Okay, to govern something means to regulate it. Okay, so that it has a certain internal stability and it can be relied upon to do certain things. That's what the word means. And this idea of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we must always look at the word happiness in that late 18th century sense, which was about everyone's right to a good life. And by good life, they meant a life in which you made enough wage, you had enough money to sustain yourself. It wasn't that happiness didn't mean I could buy all these luxury items. I could buy the 18th century equivalent of a yacht or a Learjet. It was about I have enough resources to carry on my business and to allow my family a decent life. That's what it was about.
Our founders were afraid that the Republic could fall apart at any moment, as we were talking about. They also felt, many of them felt, if we write this strong constitution and we try to see to it that we have a reasonably well-educated populace and we have a system of checks and balances and we get people into office who have some honor and integrity, then it might last a while.
Right, a little bit. Yeah.
A little bit.
A little bit. I mean, Franklin and Jefferson were both of the same mind that it was a generational thing, that every generation there probably needed to be a revolution, and maybe the whole darn thing was going to get revised completely. So there were differing points of view on that. And you have to remember, too, that the decade after the Constitution becomes the law of the land, America bears witness to the French Revolution, the implosion of our strongest ally in the Revolutionary War. So for people who were believers in the strong government that the Constitution enshrined, people like John Adams, the French Revolution was a cautionary tale, because they could look and say, see, look what happens. Look what happens when you don't have a strong government and the mob takes over.
And you have a bloodbath.
You have a bloodbath, exactly. And then on the Anti-Federalist side, on the Jeffersonian side, it's that idea that the tree of liberty should perhaps be watered from time to time with the blood of tyrants and patriots. That this is what happens when you don't have a stable system. When you have, remember, people on the Federalist side saw the Constitution as enshrining a monarchy. Now, there was never a provision in the Constitution as originally written for term limits on a president. It wasn't there. That didn't come in until Roosevelt serves four terms, and after that, a lot of his enemies said, we've got to restrict that. So it was Washington. We were just really lucky with our first executive, because Washington, after two terms, said two terms is enough, and that became the unofficial tradition until it was actually codified as an amendment. And Washington said, I think, to the American public, that's not our government. We don't have kings here. And I've served the liberty of the people, and now I'm going to go retire to my farm. That whole Cincinnatus Act that Washington would put on from time to time. So I love having this conversation now, you know, in our current political strife, but having to talk about the Constitution not necessarily being everybody's favorite document. And what I wish people would do is read it from time to time. it seems to me, and I try to be as ecumenical in listening to people as I can be, but often the loudest voices about, oh, we've got to have strict constructionists on the court and things, I think they'd be kind of surprised by what's actually in the Constitution. The fluidity of that document is a kind of revelation. Can you really be a strict constructionist as a judge? Here's why I think that's problematic. Because to say the founders didn't anticipate things is to say that this remarkable group of men who established the government under which we live today were simply living for their generation. They were not. When you look at their letters and when you look at their public addresses, the word posterity crops up all the time. I'd love to do a word search of it and just see, just put in all, you know, Washington, Adams, Jefferson, Hamilton, Madison, everybody, and see how many times posterity comes up. They were thinking about it. You know, could Thomas Jefferson have anticipated social media and the internet? Of course not. Would he believe that the same principles apply to the media of his time? Absolutely. To say anything less is to demean the founding generation.
So you've got people who thought that it's inevitable or near inevitable that republics fall, and now we are a giant empire. We're a giant military, economic, industrial empire with all the good and all the bad that flows from that for ourselves, for our people, for the environment, for the world. And yet we have, I think, as Americans, this sort of like belief that we may have problems, but our republic is kind of going to go on and on forever.
Right.
And yet you've got these quotations. Maybe you can read one from Alexander Hamilton about real threats to the republic by people who were not so much, I mean, it's one thing for a dictator to take over against the will of the people, but then you've got the idea of a demagogue who is elected and beloved by a large number of the people.
Sure. So let me read this quote, and then let's expand on Hamilton's thought here and about the nature of society in that period. Hamilton said in a later letter, "When a man unprincipled in private life, desperate in his fortune, bold in his temper, possessed of considerable talents, having the advantage of military habits, despotic in his ordinary demeanor, known to have scoffed in private at the principles of liberty, when such a man is seen to mount the hobby horse of popularity," I love that phrase, "to join in the cry of danger to liberty, to take every opportunity of embarrassing the general government and bringing it under suspicion, to flatter and fall in with all the nonsense of the zealots of the day, it may justly be suspected that his object is to throw things into confusion, that he may, quote, ride the storm and direct the whirlwind." So, one of the amazing things about this generation is they wrote letters all the time. Their body of work is voluminous. And many of them, like Adams and Jefferson especially, lived long enough to experience what they saw as the betrayal of everything they worked for. And that came with the election of Andrew Jackson, who was America's first great populist president, and made no bones about whipping up an anti-government fury. That's one of the issues that we constantly deal with. In the case of Adams and Jackson, remember that John Quincy Adams became president in 1824 in a contested election that a lot of people thought Andrew Jackson won. But by then, the popular spirit was such that the elder statesmen in our country could see where things were going. And Jackson's rise to success coincides with the second great religious awakening in America and a strong evangelical, almost millennial spirit. Does any of this sound familiar? This was always what Hamilton writes about in that letter, is always what people were guarding against and cautioning against, and believed that the system that they had put in place would prevent somebody like Jackson's worst excesses from reaching destructive measures. You can argue about the Jackson presidency, what he tried to do or not do. I mean, he really hated the Bank of the United States, which was Hamilton's baby, and tried everything he could to undo it. And of course, and under Jackson, our Indian removal policies, which were already pretty reprehensible reached genocidal proportion.
So here you are spending your life, your career, looking at the founders and living in the present, observing our own time, seeing the resonances, as you've alluded to several times.
Right.
Seeing what is like, what is unlike, what is new. I mean, as you say, they couldn't have imagined this level of technology and social media that we have today. And that affects who we are and how we think. And yet, when I look at that time, it feels so familiar.
Exactly.
So American. So, like, I could be, except for the clothing or whatever, you could be walking down the streets of New York or Boston. And it just feels like I know this place. This is who I am.
Right. Well, I grew up on Westerns. I love Westerns. I love Western movies, love Western literature, all things Western. I grew up in the West. And so spent a good chunk of my adult life believing that, as so many Americans do, that we are the heirs of that great pioneer generation who came West, or what, the Manifest Destiny generation. But in doing research for a project like John Adams, which took me over 6 years, I came to this startling conclusion that you've just articulated, that we are in fact much, much closer in our concerns to the founding generation. The arguments we have over government today are the same arguments they had that result in the Constitution. And we are very, very much still within their orbit.
So as citizens today who are contemplating this, who are maybe concerned, frightened, who see all kinds of injustices happening, especially toward the most vulnerable citizens and residents of our country, who want to ensure domestic tranquility and form a more perfect union,
right,
and are concerned with the general welfare and security of our people, how do we think about being a good citizen?
Well, good citizenship, I'm sorry, civics isn't taught anymore. It's been thrown out of Common Core, for instance, this idea of what your responsibility as an American means. And by that, it is becoming civically active. It is, when you're old enough to vote, you vote. You don't say, I'm not voting as a protest, as so many people do, regardless of their generational background. That's not what we do. We have a responsibility to serve. The founders believed in this word duty. That there was, when called to serve, almost all of them served, no matter what the sacrifice was, personally, professionally, and to their families. We don't have that ethic anymore, because the distrust of government, whether you believe distrust is merited or not, okay, it has created a society, and I won't even say a generation, a society where we believe there's nothing I can do. I'm not going to make a difference. Well, you can. You start on the local level, because that is where everything begins. And it manifests itself from a local level to a state level to a regional level and ultimately to a national level. We here in the West are representatives of that. The West, from its founding, has been a crucible of all the great American ideals, whether it's immigration or what is the proper economy to build? All of that is stuff that has been tried here in the West, and it's why it's one of the fastest growing sectors, both in terms of demographics and the American economy. But we have a bigger problem, I think, and it's this idea that we continue as voters, whether we are on the hard left or on the hard right, because I don't know there's anybody in the middle anymore.
And what those terms even mean, you know, they don't, as we talked about, they don't map onto anything. Just sort of arbitrary right now.
But the idea that, no, I'd rather the government shut down than enact legislation. I want to be a part of the party of no. How would that have worked in the debates in the Continental Congress about independence from England? You know, our government is predicated on the ability of people on every side to listen and to reach reasonable compromises. And now you say the word compromise, and you might as well be saying the word traitor. But that is how our government was founded. That's how the Constitution was debated and ultimately how it was written. Not everybody got what they wanted. That's the nature of government. That's what they're talking about when they talk about duty and responsibility going hand in hand with liberty. We have, as it seems now, to our greatest peril, forgotten one half of that argument, that duty and responsibility argument. And we have got to get that ethic back. Otherwise, the situation in which we find ourselves now is going to get a whole hell of a lot worse before it gets better.
Kirk Ellis, thank you so much for being with us.
I love talking to you, Mary Charlotte. It's great having this kind of reasoned discussion that I was just talking about.
There we go. Thank you. You've been listening to The Radio Cafe. I'm your host, Mary Charlotte. This program is brought to you in part by Dotfoil Computer Services, providing computer repair and business services for Apple and PC. They're Santa Fe's only Apple-authorized service provider. You can find them on the web at dotfoil.com and in the Candyman Center in Santa Fe. This program is produced in collaboration with the Santa Fe New Mexican, an independent newspaper since 1849. The New Mexican is on the web at santafenewmexican.com, where you can find out about our community and you can subscribe to the digital and paper editions. You can also find previous episodes of The Radio Cafe on the web at radiocafe.org. And if you want to send any feedback on the show, ideas, or comments, please write an email to feedback@radiocafe.org. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.